under United States protection, trampling on the human rights of world citizens, aren't they? The Human Rights Toolkit is universally applicable, and there are many countries on Earth, including the United States of America, that have a problem with democracy and human rights. Isn't it a crying shame that an average black American lives 6 years less than his white countrymen? Don't black Americans get locked up in jails in much larger numbers than whites? But the United States' human rights standards are highly selective. It's the white man's burden. Evidently, the toolkit becomes a potent weapon to stigmatize the United States' rivals, Russia and China, and to pressure small countries that do not conform to America's wrong policies, countries like Sri Lanka, Cuba, and Venezuela. The toolkit has been used to bring about regime change too, that is, overthrow established governments and replace them with client regimes. The best-known examples are Ukraine and Georgia. A recent attempt has been made in Belarus, but that flopped. A trial project in Russia in recent weeks was simply squashed by the Kremlin. But it is a developing story. The countries in the periphery of Russia are being systematically destabilized and turned into theaters of geopolitical contestation so that the United States' great rival will get entrapped in a quagmire. The Biden administration is using this toolkit to try to establish the United States' so-called transatlantic leadership, which Europe is no longer comfortable with. Europe is experiencing the hidden charms of strategic autonomy. But the US cannot hope to exercise global hegemony without the Western alliance system backing it either. In the shadow play, Joe Biden estimates that the human rights plank stands the best chance of bringing the United States' Western allies on board under its leadership. Indeed, the Western concept of human rights, narrowly focused on freedom of speech and freedom of religion and democratic elections, tends to overlook that the basic right of the bulk of humanity is about the right to life and the right to development. The Western countries refuse to accept the fact that there are many roads to development and prosperity for the developing countries, and their path is only one of them, and perhaps not even the best or the most suitable path. Plainly put, human rights are being used as a tool to reinforce and perpetuate the present global order in accordance with Western interests. However, it is a losing battle. A new world order is taking shape with a vastly different global humanitarian agenda, which will inevitably become the mainstream for human society. According to a plan jointly issued recently by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China and the State Council on China's Comprehensive Transportation Network layout, the country aims to build all over the world 200,000 kilometers of railways, 460,000 kilometers of highways, and 25,000 kilometers of high-level sea lanes, with 27 major coastal ports, 400 civil transportation airports, and 80 express hubs by 2035. Which will make the country not only a global production center, but a logistics center, trade center, clearing center, and financial center, laying a solid foundation for a path to be the world's economic center, as an expert put it. How could the Biden administration possibly counter this latest Chinese challenge? Unsurprisingly, the United States is at its wit's end in dealing with China's surge. In 2020, China's gross domestic product was more than 70% the size of the United States. The current forecast is that it will surpass the United States to be the world's largest economy by 2028. The US realizes that the economic race is pretty much already lost.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The Land of the Enlightened, directed by Belgian photographer Pieter-Jan Depew. And joining me in this episode are Kalim Aftab, who is a film critic and freelance writer who writes for the independent newspaper primarily. And beside him, we are also joined by Jonathan Steele, who is a veteran foreign correspondent and author of widely acclaimed studies of international relations. He is also the author of Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. Now, this film captures Afghanistan's legacy of invasion, war, and conflict. The Land of the Enlightened is a docudrama that strives for a dreamlike reality to convey the fundamental divergence in worldviews between the US occupiers and the ethnic groups that have inhabited the region for millennia. Combining narrative and non-fiction techniques, the documentary's initial scenes present the first of many spectacular panoramas of Afghanistan's dramatic landscapes, while also following the operating base defended by US and Afghan soldiers who are attempting to neutralize Taliban advances on the periphery of the zone controlled by coalition forces. First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I thought the documentary offered a great vantage point into the power vacuum of the war-torn country that is Afghanistan. And also, it focuses on a group of Afghan children who act as a gang and collect opium and other valuables and seem to trade them and live in parallel with the US soldiers. Kalim, if I could turn to you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this documentary?
Well, first off, I think the first impression is the cinematography is so luscious and beautiful. The director used to be a photographer, so it's no surprise he had an eye for that. And then what we find is this documentary that I found was very beautiful, and the kids were amazing. But there was some strange stuff going on. The voiceover was in a different voice that was presumably Nasser to the Nasser we see on the screen. So it has this dreamlike quality where we're not quite sure what's going on as we're watching it, and it plays out as vignettes rather than as a very strong narrative.
That's some interesting points to make. And it's very arty, I suppose, the feel of the documentary. And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what's your impression of this film?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a very romantic film in terms of the use of landscape, the snow, the caravans, the camels, and these kids rushing around. But it is a little bit simplifying and not entirely accurate. When it ends, that trailer saying the Afghans are still waiting for their king, I think that's not true anymore. Mm-hmm. People now in a much more modern kind of society, half the country living in urban situations, they're not in these beautiful, remote, windswept landscapes anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's become a much more modern country than the film shows, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps you could shed more light on the political context, actually, of this film. And Kalim, I'd like to ask you, actually, this film won an award at the Sundance Film Festival for cinematography. And I suppose it's refreshing to see these landscapes and scenes when we always think of Afghanistan as a war-torn country.
I think it's refreshing. He's taken a lead from kind of Werner Herzog, who went to Iraq and showed these beautiful, like, oil fields up in flames and made them look beautiful. And here he's gone, he's used a 16mm camera, which we don't see so much film anymore. So already that kind of luscious quality, that kind of romantic quality is there. And then with his eye as a photographer, I think it's just no surprise that him and his DP created such a beautiful looking film.
Mm-hmm.
of soft music when you talk about taking over a country without people knowing. Step one is you get the support of the locals. I'm going to trade them brass for scarves and whatnot. I figure that will stimulate their economy. They can melt it down and make IEDs out of it. Get rupees from the Pakistanis and brass from us. It'll be good. Good for everyone involved. Step number two, becoming king of Afghanistan, is once we pull out, I'm going to stay behind. I'm going to hide in a conspicuous vehicle, something nobody has around here, maybe a white Toyota Camry wagon. There's not too many of those rolling around here. I'm going to hide out for a little bit, and then I'm going to grow a beard out. And I might become supreme overlord of just a province, one province at a time. I might migrate to Pakistan, cross the border a couple times. I don't know yet. But I definitely want to have an army of children, because they frighten me. And I think they're like clowns. They scare people just because they're so innocent.
I get the impression from watching the US soldiers that they seem to be living in a bubble there on the outpost, and I seem to get the impression also that they don't really want to be there either. I see you nodding your head there, Jonathan. Did you get that impression?
Well,
I also
thought that was one of the best bits of the film, actually, the sort of pointlessness of the American occupation and what the hell they were doing. They didn't know themselves. And then this very naive speech that one of the officers gives to a group of Afghans who sit there completely silent. You know, you can try and read their minds, but they're saying, what is this man talking about? You know, who is he? What right has he got to be standing here? Yeah. So I think that was really great. And then the firing, too, the Americans just blasting away at some hillside. Nobody else in sight. They couldn't see what the so-called enemy was supposed to be.
We have a clip of that, actually. We don't want to give too much away just yet.
Okay,
but we won't spoil the plot.
But, you know, the pointlessness of the American occupation.
I suppose that's a symbolic message. And Kaleem, would you agree with that? What did you make of their contribution in this documentary and how they
portrayed? I really like the way that the director made a film about little groups, a little group of kids, and then the group of American soldiers, and the juxtaposition between the two of them. So in one scene, you're watching this pointlessness, and we bring a lot of baggage to the film of what we think could be happening. And he's just saying it's mindless. But he doesn't really hammer home that point. He's just showing, and show and tell is a good filmmaking technique.
It's a beautiful film indeed. And I just want to move on briefly now to something in the beginning of the film. It's established very on that Afghanistan, through the narration, has been a war-torn country for a long time, and it's been plagued and prone to invasion. Jonathan, if I can ask you, how accurate is this point that the documentary makes?
Well, in the modern times, of course, it's been at war since 1979 when the Soviet Union set its troops in there. And really, that war has continued until today. But in the medieval period, as they point out, Genghis Khan came, and there was Nasrallah, the king, who was overthrown. But actually, a lot of the kids that we saw were probably the descendants of Genghis Khan. So they are the children of invaders. But this is a country that's at the crossroads of Central Asia, and so it's obviously one that many foreigners have tramped through and tried to conquer after Alexander the Great. The city of Kandahar, which we all know is named after Kandahar, is the corruption of Alexander. Mm-hmm. He founded that city. So there have always been foreigners coming through. But I think the point that ought to be made, and isn't made well enough in the film, is that the civil war is also there. It's not just a question of kind of united Afghans against the foreigner. There's a civil war going on, and really that's what the struggle is now about. There's the Afghan army with the Americans helping them, and then there's the Taliban on the other side, and even the terrible IS, has come into Afghanistan recently. Mm-hmm. And so it's partly foreigners coming in and partly Afghans fighting among themselves.
Mm. So it's an incredibly complex issue, Afghanistan, and you can't explain it all in one film. So I suppose, so watching this scene, I was worried that the children might be there in the mountains when they were shooting. But I would like to talk actually a bit more about the children now, since they're such a central part of this film. It seems really young to be dealing with this situation and the gravity of it all. And this film suggests that actually that there's a codependent relationship, I suppose, between the children and the US soldiers, in that they are trading with the leftover ammunition, other equipment, and so forth. But then it makes you think, on the other hand, actually, they wouldn't be in the situation if there wasn't an invasion in the first place. Did this message resonate with you also?
I think what resonated more was the actual image of ammunition and how ammunition had become something that it wasn't meant to be. You see the soldiers just shooting into minder scenes, asking if it's an internet game, which is very true. But with the kids, they're bartering with the ammunition. They're also using it to weigh opium at one stage. It's become something that's so everyday, but it's not actually about the ammunition. It's not about the war. It's about this, as you say, codependency. And he shows that in a way without overbearing the point, which I like. But ammunition is a big key part of this film. Mm.
And also, Jonathan, I just want to get your views, actually. What do you make of this sort of fight for survival for these children and the way that they have to depend on these US ammunition to get by?
Well, that's what made me feel, I wasn't sure how realistic it was, really. I mean, these are, let's face it, child soldiers. And it's terrible that children are put in this position. We see nothing about their families, apart from one boy who wants to marry the girl next door, as it were, and has to ask the father, obviously, for permission. But apart from that, there's no sense of families or what the parents think about it. Do the parents want the kids to be doing this? Are these orphans? Where are they living? I mean, so that's why I thought it was over-romantic, you know, seeing these sort of kids being grown-ups already earlier before that time.
Actually, I did some research, and according to the charity Save the Children, nearly a third of all children in Afghanistan are actually unable to attend school, leaving them potentially more vulnerable at risk of child labour and exploitation and so forth. And there's also the issue of early marriages and sort of obviously the drug problem, which is quite prominent in the film.
Well, there's also the unexploded ordnance, you know, so you know, the landmines. They're unscrewing that scene. There's a scene where the boy unscrews a landmine to try and defuse it, to take it off, to be sold. I mean, you know, and the other kids are sitting around within 4 feet of him, so if the thing does blow up, you know, several kids are going to get killed. I mean, there's a real danger. A lot of children are dying of unexploded ordnance, but more by accident than because they're trying to sell it. You know, they trip on it, they think it's a toy, they pick it up, it blows up in their face. So it is a serious problem.
So there is obviously a direct connection between sort of the US invasion and foreign intervention and the risk that these children have.
Well, some of these mines, I think, may be left over from the Soviet Union. They look more like Soviet mines to me, which are used by the Mujahideen and the Taliban as well, because they've got stocks of them. So it goes back before the US occupation to the Soviet occupation.
Mm. And did you want anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, those scenes, because they're actually reenactments. So part of this film is documentary and part of it is reenactment. And I think those films jar, because those scenes, sorry, jar, because they are reenactments and we're watching little children act. Mm. And you can see them act sometimes. It doesn't feel as natural as some other bits of the movie.
Now we're just in the final part of the discussion about this film. And I just wanted to ask you, Kaleem, that some of the criticisms of this film is that it doesn't follow a classical narrative structure. But then perhaps one could argue that actually that this reflects a lot of reality because the war itself didn't have a narrative.
Yeah, I think the film has a lot of vignettes, as I said previously, and it shows the groups. And he wants it to have a documentary feel in terms of the structure, in terms of, oh, I've just managed to catch this by accident. But he falls down a little bit because he has reenactments, and that jars with that. And then also you see scenes like the helicopters flying, and it makes you think of narratives like Apocalypse Now and Platoon, and it takes you away from the documentary feel. So I think that, in a little way, which I really liked about it because it made it feel like a dream, but it moved it to a heightened reality. And I can see why that's a problem for a lot of people.
But perhaps, actually, I was just thinking it will draw in sort of political people and non-political also in sort of terms of a compromise. But just to talk about more about the politics of the situation, earlier on in the film, actually, also talked about, it mentioned Obama reporting that there'd be 9,800 or so more troops that will remain after 2014, which is when combat operations formally ended. But then in late 2017, President Trump announced that he wanted to send an additional 3,000 troops to the country. I mean, what do you think the plan is for the US in Afghanistan?
Well, if I can just add to one point that was made earlier. I was talking about how the Soviet occupation preceded the Afghan, the American one. That clip we've just seen of the helicopters, the poem that was being said and being sung, was actually Russian. It comes from the Afghansi, as they were called, the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. So it was clever of the director to merge the two, although perhaps he should have explained it a bit more, that these people were actually singing in Russian.
There's some subliminal messages there, perhaps.
More messages. We're coming on to what you said. Yes, there are now today 14,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and Obama had hoped to bring them out all together by the time he packed up as president a year and a bit ago. So it's an open-ended wall. It's a quagmire. It's a pit, you know, in which they've fallen and they can't get out of. But the worst thing is really the Afghan troops. I said it was a civil war. The Afghan troops are also fighting. It's not just the Americans. They're losing something like 20 soldiers a day, more than 8,000 a year. If you think that the Americans themselves only lost 2,400 in 15 years, and the Afghans are losing 8,000 a year, the rate of attrition is colossal, which is why there's massive desertion. People don't sign up again, and they try and avoid being conscripted, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Terrible indeed. I wish we could talk more, actually, because there's just so much to talk about. But actually, I just wanted to get your final thoughts on the film now. Killeen, what's your final thoughts on this documentary, and would you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it, but I would recommend it for kind of the romanticism and poeticness of it, and that is very different to other documentaries on the subject, for its uniqueness, rather than perhaps its political message.
And Jonathan, your final thoughts on the film?
Well, I would agree with that. I think it's a sort of good introduction, you know, get in there. It points to some complex issues in a simplistic way, but it's because it's so romantically filmed and brilliantly filmed, it should get people more interested to learn more.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests again. And for you, I've been Camilla Shambriati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Vaccination doesn't 100% prevent you from getting infected, but in all cases it gives your immune system a huge leg up on the coronavirus. Whatever your outcome, whether complete protection from infection or some level of disease, you will be better off after encountering the virus than if you hadn't been vaccinated. We have prepared for you an article written by Deborah Fuller. The piece is titled, Can Vaccinated People Still Spread the Virus? The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Deborah Fuller's article. So you've got your coronavirus vaccine, you've waited the 2 weeks for your immune system to respond to the shot, and are now fully vaccinated. Does this mean you can make your way through the world like the old days without fear of spreading the virus? Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine, working on coronavirus vaccines. She explains what the science shows about transmission post-vaccination and whether new variants of the virus could change this equation. Question number one, does vaccination completely prevent infection? The short answer is no. You can still get infected after you've been vaccinated, but your chances of getting seriously ill are almost zero. Many people think vaccines work like a shield, blocking a virus from infecting cells altogether. But in most cases, a person who gets vaccinated is protected from disease, not necessarily infection. Every person's immune system is a little different, so when a vaccine is 95% effective, that just means 95% of people who receive the vaccine won't get sick. These people could be completely protected from infection, or they could be getting infected but remain asymptomatic because their immune system eliminates the virus very quickly. The remaining 5% of vaccinated people, though, can become infected and get sick, but are extremely unlikely to be hospitalized. Vaccination doesn't 100% prevent you from getting infected, but in all cases, it gives your immune system a huge leg up on the coronavirus. Whatever your outcome, whether complete protection from infection or some level of disease, you will be better off after encountering the virus than if you hadn't been vaccinated. Question number two, does infection always mean transmission? Transmission happens when enough viral particles from an infected person get into the body of an uninfected person. In theory, anyone infected with the coronavirus could potentially transmit it, but a vaccine will reduce the chance of this happening. In general, if vaccination doesn't completely prevent infection, it will significantly reduce the amount of virus coming out of your nose and mouth, a process called shedding, and shorten the time that you shed the virus. This is a big deal. A person who sheds less virus is less likely to transmit it to someone else. This seems to be the case with coronavirus vaccines. In a recent preprint study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, researchers tested 2,897 vaccinated people for signs of coronavirus infection. Most had no detectable virus, but people who were infected had one quarter the amount of virus in their bodies as unvaccinated people tested at similar times post-infection. Less coronavirus means less chance of spreading it, and if the amount of virus in your body is low enough, the probability of transmitting it may reach almost zero. However, researchers don't yet know where that cutoff is for the coronavirus. And since the vaccines don't provide 100% protection from infection, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommends that people continue to wear face masks and social distance even after they've been vaccinated. Question number three, what about the new coronavirus variants? New variants of coronavirus have emerged in recent months, and recent studies show that vaccines are less effective against certain ones, like the B1351 variant, first identified in South Africa. Every time the SARS-CoV-2 replicates, it gets new mutations. In recent months, researchers have found new variants that are more infective, meaning a person needs to breathe in less virus to become infected, and other variants that are more transmissible, meaning they increase the amount of virus a person sheds. And according to early data, researchers have also found at least one new variant that seems to be better at evading the human immune system. Question number four. So how does this relate to vaccines and transmission? For the South African variant, vaccines still provide greater than 85% protection from getting severely ill with COVID-19. But when you count mild and modest cases, they provide at best only about 50 to 60% protection. That means at least 40% of vaccinated people will still have a strong enough infection and enough virus in their body to cause at least moderate disease. If vaccinated people have more virus in their bodies and it takes less of that virus to infect another person, there will be higher probability a vaccinated person could transmit these new strains of the coronavirus. If all goes well, vaccines will very soon reduce the rate of severe disease and death worldwide. To be sure, any vaccine that reduces disease severity is also, at a population level, reducing the amount of virus being shed overall. But because of the emergence of new variants, vaccinated people still have the potential to shed and spread the coronavirus to other people, vaccinated or otherwise. This means it will likely take much longer for vaccines to reduce transmission and for populations to reach herd immunity than if these new variants had never emerged. Exactly how long that will take is a balance between how effective vaccines are against emerging strains and how transmissible and infectious these new strains of coronavirus are.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kademi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
So, the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. There is a great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center twin buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, emotional, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader or chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together and stressing what they have in common and being, in a way, friends and affirming a message of which is common to both religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotional and passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S. and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, the essence of anti-Semitism. President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962. When the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup,
sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force, and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government, junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with a military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as the Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that loop together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad airbase, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad air base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable, and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطالب.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام مرارة الدنيا حلاوة الآخرة وحلاوة الدنيا مرارة الآخرة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The sourness of this world is the sweetness of the next world, while the sweetness of this world is the sourness of the next one."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing